1776, the nation's bicentennial. Time to reflect. The Declaration of Independence and the 200 years that followed. Ups and downs, boom times and depressions. Peace and war, including a civil conflict that left the nation divided for years afterward. Population from 2 million to 225 million. Progress from agrarian colonization to the world's greatest industrial nation. Status from near zero influence to the bastion of democracy. The people reflected. Then on the weekend of July 4th, they turned out 200 million strong to celebrate the nation's birthday. And in November, they went to the polls in unprecedented numbers to elect a president to lead them into the nation's third century. The candidates were President Gerald Ford, Republican, Jimmy Carter, Democrat, and two independents, former U.S. Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota and former Georgia Governor Lester Maddox. President Ford, the only person to reach that office through appointment, representative of the party that carried the stigma of Watergate, the man who pardoned President Nixon, member of the minority party in Congress, occupant of the White House at a time when unemployment was high, inflation had not been checked, and economic recovery from a recession had leveled off. Jimmy Carter, Georgia peanut farmer, former governor of Georgia, but virtually unknown outside his state at the beginning of the year. Jimmy who was a common refrain along the primary trails, and so was the question, what does he stand for? Many voters were still asking that question after his nomination. Yet the tenor of the times was a demand for a change, for new faces in the White House and at the highest levels of government. Benefiting from this mood, Carter had a lead of 33 points in public opinion polls as he took to the hustings. Addressing the American Legion Convention, he expressed his views on how to treat Vietnam draft evaders.
I do not favor blanket amnesty, but for those who violated selective service laws, I intend to grant a blanket pardon. To me,
Carter tried to explain that amnesty implied innocence while a pardon implied guilt. The Legionnaires would have no part of that explanation. Senator Robert Dole of Kansas, President Ford's running mate, told the Legionnaires exactly what they wanted to hear.
Let there be no confusion as to President Ford's position on this issue. It's unequivocal. It applies equally to draft evaders and deserters. No blanket pardon, no blanket amnesty, no blanket clemency.
To formally open his campaign, Carter went to Warm Springs, Georgia, the summer home of Franklin D. Roosevelt when he was president.
This year is the 1932. Our nation is divided. Our people are out of work, and our national leaders do not lead. This year is the 1960. Our nation is drifting without inspiration, without vision, and without purpose.
Then Carter did something he admitted later was a mistake. He gave an interview to Playboy magazine in which he made two remarks that were to come back to haunt him. He said, "I've looked on a lot of women with lust. I've committed adultery in my heart many times." And on the subject of Vietnam, he said, "I don't think I would ever take on the same frame of mind that former Presidents Nixon or Johnson did, lying, cheating, and distorting the truth." The first remark was to cost him votes among church groups. The second was to erode his position in President Johnson's home state of Texas. He tried to make light of the Playboy interview when he introduced his wife at a rally in Philadelphia.
"And I'd like for you to meet a wonderful woman who has read the Playboy magazine article."
The Ford entourage received a scare when a firecracker exploded while the president was speaking in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
"Is not having to guess what a candidate means. Trust is leveling with the people before the election about what you're going to do after the election. Trust is not being all things to all people, but being the same thing."
Meanwhile, the League of Women Voters agreed to sponsor four debates, three between the two presidential candidates, the other between Senator Dole and his Democratic counterpart, Senator Walter Mondale of Minnesota. The first presidential debate was on economic issues. The president blamed Congress for most of the nation's economic woes.
"We've had Republican presidents before who tried to run against a Democratic Congress. And I don't think it's the Congress is Mr. Ford's opponent. But if if he insists that that I be responsible for the Democratic Congress, of which I have not been a part, then I think it's only fair that he be responsible for the Nixon administration in its entirety, of which he was a part.
Carter said he would reorganize the executive branch. He said that from the time President Nixon took office, the cost of running the White House had escalated from less than $4 million to more than $16 million.
In the 4 years that Governor Carter was governor of the state of Georgia, expenditures by the government went up over 50%. Employees of the government in Georgia during his term of office went up over 25%. And the figures also show that the bonded indebtedness of the state of Georgia during his governorship went up over 20%.
The president blundered in the second debate, which was on defense and foreign policy.
We've become fearful to compete with the Soviet Union on an equal basis. We talk about detente. The Soviet Union knows what they want in detente, and they've been getting it. We have not known what we've wanted, and we've been out-traded in almost every instance.
The president responded that there is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe and that there would not be under a Ford administration. He said the Poles, Romanians, and Yugoslavs considered themselves free. One of the panelists, Max Frankel of the New York Times, asked if he had heard the president correctly.
I don't believe, Mr. Frankel, that the Yugoslavians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Romanians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Poles consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. Each of those countries is independent, autonomous. It has its own territorial integrity. And the United States does not concede that those countries are under the domination of the Soviet Union.
After the debate, Carter ridiculed Ford's statement.
I understand the Polish Americans for Ford is disbanding. And I talked to Fritz Mondale last night, and I said, it was pretty late. I said, Fritz, are you about ready to go to bed? He said, no, I'm going to find me a Polish bar. I'm sure the drinks are on the house for all the Democrats.
The president tried to recover lost ground by saying it was all a misunderstanding, that he had intended to emphasize America's firm support of the aspirations for freedom of the nations of Eastern Europe. He said the United States has never conceded and never will concede their domination by Russia. For the most part, the presidential candidates kept the campaign at a high level. Not so their running mates. In the vice presidential debate, Dole implied that Mondale's Senate votes were dictated by labor, and he referred to the wars of this century as democratic wars. Mondale said Dole was one of President Nixon's chief defenders, and he called Dole a hatchet man for saying that World War II and the Korean War were democratic wars. As the campaign wound down, the presidential candidates engaged in their final debate, which was open to all topics and issues. Carter admitted the Playboy interview was of great concern to him and that he didn't know how to deal with it. In an exchange on the issue of unemployment,
there is a growing public confidence in the strength of this economy, and that means that there will be more industrial activity. It means that there will be a reduction in the unemployment. It means that there will be increased hires. It means that there will be increased employment.
Well, with all due respect to President Ford, I think he ought to be ashamed of making that statement, because we have the highest unemployment rate now than we had at any time between the Great Depression caused by Herbert Hoover and the time President Ford took office. We've got 7.5 million people out of jobs since he's been in office. 2.5 million more American people have lost their jobs.
The concluding remarks.
There has been a restoration of faith and confidence and trust in the presidency because I've been open, candid, and forthright. I have never promised more than I could produce, and I have produced everything that I promised. We are at peace. Not a single young American is fighting or dying on any foreign soil tonight.
I believe that if we are inspired, if we can achieve a degree of unity, if we can set our goals high enough and work toward recognized goals with industry and labor and agriculture, along with government at all levels, that we can achieve great things. We might have to do it slowly. There are no magic answers to it. But I believe together we can make great progress. We can correct our difficult mistakes.
As Election Day approached, it was evident that something had happened to Jimmy Carter on his way to the White House. That 33-point margin in the polls had disappeared. Now, the pollsters were calling the election a toss-up, with Carter still in the lead, but with the ominous figure of Senator McCarthy lurking in the background. The pollsters were right. On Election Day, 79 million Americans went to the polls, and it turned out to be one of the closest presidential contests in history. With the South solidly behind him, and with Pennsylvania and New York in his column, Carter was within striking distance of victory. Then the final results started to come in from west of the Mississippi. They were solid Republican. It was nearly 4 a.m. in the east before the poll watchers decided it was safe to call the winner, Carter by a nose. Senator McCarthy almost succeeded in playing the spoiler role. He cost Carter 26 electoral votes in Iowa, Maine, Oklahoma, and Oregon. It was near dawn when Carter went to the podium at his Atlanta headquarters.
This tremendous crowd at 4 o'clock in the morning represents hundreds of millions of American people who are now ready to see our nation unified, and I want to congratulate the toughest and most formidable opponent that anyone could possibly have, President Gerald Ford.
Carter then flew home to Plains, Georgia, where he broke down.
I came all the way through 22 months, and I didn't get choked up until I...
Carter turned to his wife, who was in tears, and embraced her. Regaining his composure, he told his neighbors,
"All of us will be proud that we were up all night last night, and we meet here with the sun rising in the east. I think the sun's rising on a beautiful new day, a beautiful new spirit in this country, a beautiful new commitment to the future. I feel good about it."
The president held out hope to the last. It was 11 a.m. in Washington before he conceded. He had lost his voice in the final days of the campaign, so the First Lady read his concession telegram.
"Dear Jimmy, it is apparent now that you have won our long and intense struggle for presidency. I congratulate you on your victory. As one who has been honored to serve the people of this great land, both in Congress and as president, I believe that we must now put divisions of the campaign behind us and unite the country once again in the common pursuit of peace and prosperity."
Certainly project me, I think, into the top three.
You here tonight and throughout the past weeks in New Hampshire have made it possible for us to put together this campaign that's going to sweep across this country and provide the kind of leadership the people of America have a right to expect.
We've been able to set the framework for the issues.
We've run strong in every part of this state in all kinds of different wards and areas. And this campaign has a wide base of support that augurs well for the contest down the road.
Well, I will do well in Massachusetts. When you say, how well will I do? I'm not sure. But I'll tell you this. Every day I'm going to be gaining in Massachusetts, just as I did here.
That was a montage of the voices of the five Democratic candidates after the New Hampshire presidential primary. In order, they were Jimmy Carter, beginning to emerge from his Jimmy Who shell, who won 29% of the popular vote and 13 of 17 delegates, Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana, who received 16% of the popular vote, Senator Fred Harris of Oklahoma, 11%, Representative Morris Udall of Arizona, 24% and 4 delegates, and Sergeant Shriver, candidate for vice president in 1972, 9%. Except for Carter, they were all to take to the sidelines within the next few weeks. The top three Carter referred to were himself, Senator Henry Jackson of Washington, and Governor George Wallace of Alabama. Lurking in the shadows was another potential threat, Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Vice President under Lyndon Johnson, unsuccessful presidential candidate in 1968, Humphrey was hoping for a draft.
I can do more for the people of the United States right now, being a good senator, than I can being a candidate running around. Now, if my party decides in July in New York that they need me, I hope to have a smile on my face, feel good, be politically prepared in terms of the issues, physically and emotionally strong, and go out and win the election.
The Massachusetts primary seemingly established Senator Jackson as a leading candidate. But the same day, Carter scored in Vermont. Then he rang up a key victory over Governor Wallace in Florida. When Carter followed with victories in Illinois, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, Senator Jackson suspended his campaign. In an attempt to generate a Stop Carter movement, Senator Frank Church of Idaho and Governor Jerry Brown of California entered the race. Brown explained.
I've gotten into this campaign because I have the sense that the American people are looking for something that they haven't gotten yet. And out in California, I've tried to be straight. I try to talk to people in language that makes sense to me. And a problem in politics today is that political discourse has been so debased by rhetoric and cant and overpromising and overselling that people have really begun to turn off and stop listening.
Although Church and Brown won a number of primaries, it was too late to stop Carter. By the time the Democratic convention opened in New York, he was a shoo-in. Meanwhile, interesting things were happening on the Republican side. Even before New Hampshire, the president used unusually strong terms to denounce Ronald Reagan, accusing him of political demagoguery. Reagan responded.
It does come rather strange since he tried on two different occasions to persuade me to accept any of several cabinet positions in his administration, and then did subsequently appoint me to the CIA investigating commission, his presidential commission.
New Hampshire was a virtual standoff in the popular vote, but the president won 17 of the 21 state delegates to the Republican convention. After that, it was mostly seesaw, with first one candidate, then the other winning a key state. Both men campaigned hard. At Battle Creek in his home state of Michigan, the president had to deal with a heckler.
We had a lot of things to do. We had some real tough jobs to handle and some very difficult and formidable obstacles ahead of us. We blew it in the right direction, young man, and those of you who don't agree. And if you'd go out and look for a job, you'd get one.
As convention time neared, there was speculation that the president might offer Reagan second place on the ticket.
Under no circumstances whatsoever will I accept the vice presidential nomination.
Less than 3 weeks before the convention, Reagan pulled what he hoped would be a coup. He announced his choice for running mate.
Since I now feel that the people and the delegates have a right to know in advance of the convention who a nominee's vice presidential choice would be, I am today departing from tradition and announcing my selection. I have chosen the distinguished United States Senator from Pennsylvania, the Honorable Richard Schweiker. I'm convinced that this is a ticket behind which all Republicans can unite and which will lead our party to victory in November.
The choice of Schweiker, one of the most liberal of Republican senators, did not have the desired effect. It alienated some of Reagan's conservative supporters, and Schweiker failed to switch an appreciable number of convention votes, even in the Pennsylvania delegation. The Reagan forces tried another strategic move. They asked the Rules Committee to approve a change that would have required the president to name his vice presidential choice in advance. They theorized that such action would alienate some of the president's backers. Voted down in committee, the Reagan supporters took their fight to the convention floor. In a close vote, the Reagan side lost. The rest was anticlimactic. The president was nominated by a margin of 57 votes. After conferring with Reagan, the president chose as his running mate Senator Dole.
I did not expect to receive a phone call this morning, but I'm very pleased that we were in.
In an emotional talk to his campaign workers, Reagan broke down in the middle of his remarks.
Sure, there's a disappointment in what happened, but the cause goes on. And I done this once this morning, and I said I wouldn't do it again.
By comparison, the Democratic convention was cut and dried. The only suspense came in the selection of the vice presidential candidate.
I have two announcements to make. One is that I've decided to accept the nomination of president. And the other one is that I've asked to serve as my running mate if the delegates will approve Senator Walter Mondale from Minnesota.
Permit me to say that no one could be honored more than Governor Carter honored me and Joan this morning. To be selected as a vice presidential running mate at any time is a high honor and a great challenge. But particularly to be selected by this remarkable and good man who's brought so much hope and unity to this country, who will be elected President of the United States.
Some campaign and election sidelights. At the height of the campaign, Agriculture Secretary Earl Butz was identified as the source of a remark detrimental to blacks. In obscene terms, he said blacks wanted only three things in life: satisfying sex, loose shoes, and a warm place for bodily functions. There was an immediate outcry. Republican Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, himself black.
I read the statement of Secretary Earl Butz, and I find it vulgar and offensive. And I called on the president to ask for Secretary Butz's resignation. I believe that no man is fit to serve in the cabinet of the President of the United States who harbors such thoughts.
Democratic Senator George McGovern of South Dakota.
Butz has showed his contempt for human beings before, but this is far and away the worst of anything we've had yet. I don't think the president has any other alternative except to ask for Butz's resignation. He ought to be fired.
As a political liability, Butz bowed to the inevitable.
Dear Mr. President, I hereby submit my resignation as Secretary of Agriculture. I sincerely apologize for any offense that may have been caused by the unfortunate choice of language used in a recent conversation and reported publicly.
Accepting the resignation, the president said it was one of the saddest decisions of his administration. Two Senate races attracted more than usual attention in the election. In California, S.I. Hayakawa, former college president, unseated Democrat John Tunney. In New York, former U.N. Ambassador Patrick Moynihan took the seat of Republican conservative James Buckley.
New York is Democratic again. I succeed to the Senate seat of Bob Kennedy, whom I left in a hotel in San Francisco now 8 years ago. Had been campaigning for him, came back to give the commencement address at the new school, and never saw him again. But I hope to speak in his tradition again.
National interest was also attracted to New Jersey, where voters authorized gambling casinos for Atlantic City with the prospect of making it the Las Vegas of the East. Reverberations of Watergate. A federal court of appeals upheld the convictions of John Mitchell, H.R. Haldeman, and John Ehrlichman. The court also upheld the convictions of Ehrlichman and Gordon Liddy in the break-in of the office of Dr. Lewis Fielding, psychiatrist to Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked to the press the Pentagon Papers on U.S. involvement in Vietnam. The weddings of the year involved entertainers. Frank Sinatra married Barbara Marx. Richard Burton wed Susan Hunt, a British model. And Elizabeth Taylor, married six times to five husbands, identified her sixth as former Navy Secretary John Warner. Separation of the year involved the British royal family, Princess Margaret and the Earl of Snowden. Woman of the year was Barbara Walters, who left NBC and signed a five-year, $5 million contract with the ABC network to do newscasts and special programs. Other women in the news, Anne Armstrong, named ambassador to Great Britain.
I'm going to work doubly hard to be a credit to all women and to American women in particular.
Shirley Temple Black.
Mr. President, it's a high honor indeed that you've bestowed upon me. It's a great honor to be the first woman chief of protocol for the United States of America. I don't know why, Mr. President, it took 200 years for one of us to get the job. But I'll do all my very best work to try to fill all the various assorted sizes of shoes of the distinguished men who have been chief of protocol.
After Jimmy Carter's Playboy interview, his wife Rosalind was asked about his comment that he lusted in his heart for other women.
He's a great husband. I trust him completely. He's never given me any cause not to, and we have a good marriage.
First Lady Betty Ford was asked what she would do if the president said he lusted for other women.
Well, I've always said that the president enjoys to look at a pretty girl, and when he stops looking, I'm going to begin to worry.
Some names in the news. House Speaker Carl Albert of Oklahoma announcing his retirement.
During my early years in the House, I decided I should not serve beyond my 70th year. For my part, that is long enough.
Also retiring, Senate Democratic leader Mike Mansfield was asked the saddest thing he encountered in 34 years in Congress.
Watergate and the assassination. One was personal and national, and the other was personal and national, too. But if Kennedy had lived, he would have been a great president. He didn't have the chance because he was cut down short. Watergate was an abomination.
The AP's Morton Herman describes the funeral of the nation's number one crime leader.
The funeral was reminiscent of a scene from the Godfather movie as the real-life Godfather, mafia boss of bosses Carlo Gambino, was laid to rest. The quiet Brooklyn street where Our Lady of Grace Church stands was filled with mourners, the curious, the press, and local and federal plainclothes officials, straining to identify Don Carlo's possible successor to the crime leadership of the New York and New Jersey waterfronts. As the bronze casket, reported to have cost $7,000, was carried down the church steps, the bells chimed their lament, the last one anyway, for the capo di tutti capi, the boss of all bosses.